You are listening to local and regional news produced by KMUN with help from our news partners. I'm Skylar Butenchen.
It's Wednesday, October 29th. Clatsop County will be seeing a roughly 6% drop in state funding for operation of its countywide shelter system for the new 2025-2026 budget cycle. And according to County Manager Don Boone, the reductions mean some tough decisions will have to be made. The county currently partners with Clatsop Community Action, Lifeboat Services, Helping Hands, and the Harbor to provide 163 shelter beds throughout the county. At last week's Clatsop County Commissioners meeting, Boone said the county's partner organizations will need to continue to diversify their funding because there's simply not enough money to maintain the current number of shelter beds. Assistant County Manager Monica Steele says Clatsop County is still waiting to hear from the state about housing assistance funding, which is different from the money delegated for shelter beds. According to Steele, the annual point-in-time count of people experiencing homelessness in Clatsop County in January 2025 was about the same, if not slightly higher, than in January 2024. She added that in that time, over 200 households that were unhoused in the county are now housed. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. Reduced funding from the state for rapid rehousing and rental assistance was also discussed during an Astoria City Council work session with service providers this week. Katie Frankowitz reports.
Clatsop Community Action says people who currently rely on rental assistance funds are in danger of losing that help before the end of the year, with less money coming to agencies from the state.
We're trying to be as resourceful as possible, looking at different options within our community and also outside of our community.
Viviana Matthews is the executive director with Clatsop Community Action. And the landscape is not encouraging as agencies look at dwindling, delayed, or canceled funding from federal sources as well. Alan Evans is the founder and president of Helping Hands, which operates a 59-bed shelter in Astoria's Uniontown neighborhood. He says the risk of organizations like his closing their doors has never been more real.
But I'm telling you what's coming down the road here very soon, and what we're facing this year, all of our organizations here are facing drastic cuts in the way we're going to be able to provide our services. So we want to be and bring attention to that. As a matter of fact, even when some funding is distributed to this county and this community, and they negotiate contracts to take 5, 6, 7 months to do, and they have an expectation that we're going to provide that service still and hope that the money gets received here, and some of the state funding we haven't received to date that should have been released at the end of July.
On top of cuts to federal and state funding, there is the immediate and looming threat of the loss of SNAP benefits. Nationwide, millions of people rely on the food assistance program, but the program will be suspended next month if the federal shutdown continues. Dustin Martin, the chief operations officer for the Clatsop Community Action Regional Food Bank, hopes it doesn't come to that. He also noted there's a food industry that relies heavily on SNAP benefits, grocery stores, food producers, and the like. He's trying to be optimistic, but...
Let's say it doesn't get funded. They don't come up with any funding. The government doesn't open, whatever you want to call it. And people do not get their SNAP benefits the first part of November. And all those people decide to run the food banks and food pantries. We're in trouble. We're going to run out of food. Maybe not completely out of food, but we'll have a few scraps of something laying around. So yeah, we're worried about that.
Most of the food the regional food bank distributes directly to people or to community pantries and through other community programs comes from outside of Clatsop County. Andrea Birch, deputy director with Clatsop Community Action, says they have already been receiving calls from people asking how they can help. They're working on a mailer to go out into the community, telling people how to donate online or in person to community programs. Martin says food and money donations will help. This week, the Astoria School District also sent out a message to families providing information about other local food resources if SNAP benefits are suspended. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
Oregon and Washington are going to court to force the Trump administration to fund the federal food assistance program known as SNAP. OPB's Bryce Dole reports if the government shutdown continues, people who receive SNAP benefits won't get them next month.
Two dozen states are suing the U.S. Department of Agriculture over the potential lapse in SNAP benefits. The states are asking a judge to order the federal agency to use its reserves to fund the program, but the federal government says it lacks the funds and legal authority to do this. The states allege that Congress appropriated billions of dollars for expressly this purpose. Congress has so far failed to pass a spending package to reopen the government and fund programs like SNAP. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield issued a statement on Tuesday. He said the federal government, quote, has the authority and the money to keep SNAP running, and refusing to do so is both illegal and deeply cruel. About 1 in 6 Oregonians receive monthly food stamp benefits. I'm Bryce Dole, reporting.
A new proposal in Washington would substantially widen setbacks away from small, non-salmon-bearing streams. The proposed rule change is in response to a recent study from the Washington Department of Ecology that says wider buffer zones are necessary to ensure fish-bearing streams remain cold enough. But opponents of the proposal, which include rural counties and forestry groups, argue that over the course of time, the loss of timber acreage will add up to billions in lost local economic activity. Last week, Pacific County Commissioners Jerry Doyle, Lisa Olson, and David Tobin sent a letter to the Washington Forest Practices Board making clear their opposition to the proposed increase in timber harvest buffer zones along streams. The commissioners say if the proposal is approved on November 12th, the overall impact in western Washington could mean annual losses of up to $175 million for the next 45 years. In Pacific County alone, opponents say the regulation is predicted to result in an immediate timber value loss and an estimated 11.9% reduction in harvestable timber. And commissioners say that would have a real impact on school districts that rely heavily on timber revenue, including the Nacelle, Willapa Valley, and North River school districts. They say other county services like local fire and EMS districts, the Timberland Regional Library, and Willapa Harbor Hospital would also suffer. The county commission's letter to the state alleges historical neglect of rural counties, including failure to allow control of burrowing shrimp in Willapa Bay. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Next Tuesday, November 4th, is Election Day. Eligible voters in Pacific County have until 8 p.m. on Tuesday, November 4th, to return their ballot via an official county drop box. Ballots returned via mail must be postmarked on or before Election Day. Each of the three seats up for election for the Ocean Beach School District Board of Directors is being contested. Other contested races include the Ilwaco mayor position and seats on both the Port of Ilwaco and Port of Peninsula's commissions. Accessible voting equipment is available at the auditor's office in South Bend. In South Pacific County, 24-hour ballot drop boxes are located at the County Annex Building on Sandridge Road, the Peninsula Senior Activity Center in Ocean Park, the Friends of Chinook School, and the Washington State Patrol Office in Nacelle. You're listening to KMUN. Turning now to regional news, almost 2,000 wildfires were reported across Washington state during the 2025 wildfire season. they destroyed about a quarter of a million acres. But 94% of those fires were brought under control before they reached 10 acres. Lands Commissioner Dave Upthegrove attributes that feat in part to significant funding the legislature passed in 2020. Upthegrove says it's crucial that lawmakers see the need to continue funding firefighting and prevention efforts at adequate levels.
This last year, due to tough budget times, the funding we have for wildfire prevention response was cut in half. And if that funding isn't restored, we're going to see more fires, bigger fires, and more cost to taxpayers.
Upthegrove says the legislature will have to pay the bill either way, either before the fire season to help with forest thinning and other preemptive projects and equipment, or at the end of the fire season to pay for the cost of fighting the fires.
I'm Sylvia Thorpe. People in Walla Walla want to make sure there's enough water to go around in the future, and their concerns are deepening as the climate changes. Since 2019, groups in Walla Walla have worked on a basin-wide water plan. The goal is to improve things like water quality, supply, and policy. The basin stretches across the Washington-Oregon border. That complicates the problem. Travis Trumbull is on the Walla Walla Basin Advisory Committee. He spoke at a recent open house about future plans. Trumbull says that a lot of complex solutions are in the works.
We have the tools and the strategy and the plan to get us there.
Trumbull says right now they're studying how much water is needed and how much is available for irrigators.
Now, heading to Oregon, Lane County is the latest local government to sign a contract with AI license plate reader company Flock Safety. KLCC's Rebecca Hansen-White reports.
Lane County has signed a two-year, $130,000 contract with Flock Safety, according to documents KLCC obtained with a public records request. The technology will allow deputies to search for vehicles based on license plates, or use AI to search for visual characteristics like color and model. The sheriff's office says the county's cameras have not yet been installed. The contract was signed by Sheriff Carl Wilkerson in July and was for 22 Flock cameras. Eugene and Springfield already have approximately 80, but both cities have turned them off while the community discusses the privacy and civil liberties implications. The sheriff's office says the county is still working on policies for the new technology. I'm Rebecca Hansen-White, reporting.
Eugene residents have waited decades to see what would come of a plot of riverfront land that once housed the city's electric and water utility. Today, the area known as the Riverfront District is taking shape with multifamily housing and public space, with more on the way. So what went into this long-running redevelopment project? KLCC's Zach Ziegler brings us up to speed on what's been done so far.
So we're now in the River District.
It's a sunny day, and Randy Gadeka, who goes by the moniker The Walking Historian, is leading a tour through the northern part of downtown Eugene.
We had quite an industrial area. In the middle was the mill race. That began 4 miles that way at the river, and they used water wheels to capture the power from the mill race, and that was how they powered the industrial area from the 1870s up until 1928, when they switched to regular electricity.
That switch to electricity came with the building of a steam plant, and then the headquarters of the Eugene Water and Electric Board. E-Web's eventual move cleared the path for what today is the kind of large urban infill project that rarely comes along in cities the size of Eugene. Portland-based developer Atkins Dame was selected by the city of Eugene to take on the project. Jim Atkins is a principal and partner with the firm.
Last year we opened Heartwood, which is 95 homes. Today we're celebrating the opening of Portal, which are 130 homes, everywhere from studio apartments to family-friendly three-bedroom apartments.
But 200-plus new market-rate apartments aren't the only thing coming to the area. It's part of an infill development that's been in the works for decades.
So this property was essentially a hole in the donut that was left behind after UWEB decided to move to a different site in West Eugene. And beginning in the late 1990s, the city and UWEB began planning on how they would redevelop this as a multifamily mixed-use neighborhood.
One of those mixed uses, a playground like this one just south of City Hall. Joining me here are Eugene Mayor Karin Knudsen and the city's Executive Director of Planning and Development, Denny Bro.
I've had very few goosebump moments at the city, but I was standing right over there the first day the park opened, and some kids came up with their mom on bikes, and their moms were like, "Oh my God, it's open!"
Knudsen says chances like this are incredibly rare in a city.
27 acres of city center land, and a really unique once in a many generation opportunity to re-inhabit something that had been used for industry for 100 years.
In the 1990s, this spot would have been the operations yard behind eWeb's headquarters, full of trucks and equipment used to keep water and electricity flowing around the city.
Where we're standing right now would have been inside an 8-foot razor wire fence, basically impervious surface as far as the eye could see, no accessibility to the public, though it was publicly owned with our public utility. But that was the beginning of, I think, in the early 80s, people really dreaming about reconnecting the city with the river.
But realizing that dream would take decades. The area was considered a brownfield, a term that describes a place with promise for development, but not until contamination has been abated. Developer Jim Atkins.
Today, where we're at, all of the site has been declared clean by DEQ.
Before getting that Oregon Department of Environmental Quality declaration, work had to be done to ensure that any soil contaminated by metals or petroleum byproducts wouldn't harm the new residents or get into the river. Contaminated soil was either sealed under impervious surfaces like streets and building foundations or hauled to a landfill. Mayor Knudsen says development of post-industrial waterfronts is happening in many places now.
But this is a really unique one, and we're, you know, a couple of solid steps, a couple of chapters into, I think, a really good story about how the city of Eugene is taking care of land and creating more opportunities for people.
In fact, you don't have to look far for an example of former industrial space that's been given a new life, just a bit west to the 5th Street District. A mixed-use project with hotels, restaurants, and apartments that many cite as inspiration for what's happening on the riverfront. I'm Zach Ziegler reporting.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN news team that includes me, your host and producer, Skylar Butenchen, news director, Katie Frankowitz, and our intern, Sylvia Thorpe. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening.